Hello and welcome to Views Through Another Mic. This program is produced by Sound of Faith Broadcasting, and my name is Anthony Ide, the Executive Director. Our hope behind this program is to help you navigate challenging topics through a biblical lens. Our ministry prayed a lot about this program, as it can tackle many difficult topics. But we hope after listening to this program, you can start some conversations with your family and friends. Our focus is always on Jesus Christ, and we want to honor Him in everything we do. This episode is the first of two parts where you will hear from program host Ben and his guest Aaron Rock. The title of the episode is Godly and Earthly Authority.
Hello, this is Ben Hugenboss, here with Aaron Rock of Harvest Bible Church in Windsor. Welcome, Aaron, to this time where we can get together and talk a little bit about the current state of the world, the church, and some of the things that you've been up to, and really happy to have you here, so welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be on your show today.
Maybe just give a little bit of a background of who you are and the church you lead, and just a little bit about yourself to get us started.
Sure. Yeah. So my name's Aaron Rock. As you mentioned, I'm the pastor of Harvest Bible Church in Windsor. I'm in my 20th year here. I planted the church from scratch, just a small handful of us, and our church has grown to be a sizable ministry in our region. I married up. My wife's name's Susie. She's a wonderful girl. She serves in kids ministry at our church. We have five kids, and the oldest one was married 2 years ago, and we just married off another one actually this past weekend.
Wow.
And then we got a third getting married in September, so it's a busy time of year for us.
Oh, that's fantastic. I have five children myself, much younger though, so hopefully,
okay, right on.
Hopefully that is in my future. Yeah, so the reason we're sitting here is just the pandemic, the response of government and church in these times. Maybe just tell us a little bit about your experience of the lead into the pandemic and what experience was like for you and the church that you lead.
Sure. So as a church, we're very interested in the gospel of Jesus Christ. We want to teach the Bible well and introduce people to a life-saving relationship with the Lord Jesus. And so we've always been pretty active in our community and trying to, you know, connect the dots with what's going on in culture and trying to help people to work through the challenges of our world. And every Christian knows that things have gone a little nutty, shall we say, in our culture in the last several years. So we're fighting all these wars, radical ideologies and agendas, and so we're always preaching into the circumstances of life. And then last year when the pandemic touched down here in Canada, at first we were all sort of like, what in the world's going on? None of us had ever experienced this. But very soon we started to see some major problems with the government's approach. Mm-hmm. Sort of, I would call it imbalance at first, where there was a fixation on one threat and a lack of consideration for certainly the economic and the social follow-up, but mostly the spiritual consequences of locking people out of places of worship. So we met with the government in April or May of last year, and were able to negotiate a reopening plan for the provincial churches. And then, of course, we've gone through two more lockdowns since then, and you know, all the challenges and fights and the drama. And I've been charged a few times myself for seeking to keep our church open. And it's really a challenging time, and also an enlightening time for many of us, as we've just seen our nation, I think, in some respects, start to come apart at the seams.
Right. So taking back to the early response you had in working with government, I mean, you were one of the people and maybe the key person in leading that, but you had a lot of other churches sign on to what you were doing at the time. You had a lot of support, it seemed, at the time. Would that be correct? Or
I think some of your listeners probably have heard the story, maybe others haven't. So originally I wrote a letter to the premier, but before I sent it, I ran it through our elders' council, and we decided, hey, why don't we try to get some other churches on board? So I connected with Dr. Joe Boot at the Ezra Institute in Grimsby, and I heard he was working on something. So we sort of retooled the letter, and then we thought, well, maybe we can get, you know, 10, 20, 30 churches to sign this. And ultimately we had, I think it was 450 or 445 churches and a couple synagogues sign our letter. So there was a lot of interest, shall we say, in Ontario here for getting the churches open. And at that point, being maybe a bit more collaborative in terms of working with the government.
Right.
Of course, since then, you know, there's been differences of opinion as to, you know, how far you push it. Mm. And our perspective has been maybe more along the lines of trumpeting the absolute supremacy of Christ over the ministry and worship of the church. So, you know, we've taken some blows for that, and some churches have stood with us. I would say others are sort of observing or trying to figure out their own way forward.
Yeah, so it really is something that has split the church, and we know about a lot of the high profile cases, yourself included, of people who have stood up a little bit more pointedly, some to more extreme levels even. You know, there's been at least three pastors in our country that have been put in prison at some point, which is an amazing thing, of course. Mm-hmm. That division and that split, what are those on the opposing side who are against what maybe you and others are doing? What are they saying biblically to back them up, and what would your response be to them?
Yeah, sure. Well, of course, all these mandates are provincially driven, so Ontario's response is obviously a little different than mm-hmm. Alberta. Alberta's sort of done the lock them up kind of approach. Ontario, sort of their extreme measure is to lock you out of your church, which we came within a hair's breadth of, but we avoided it. So we have different responses. In terms of those that would maybe take a different view, well, I think there's a large group that just doesn't know what to do. So they actually don't have a strong opinion on it. I think that's, my sense is that's probably the majority. They're, I don't mean this in any sort of an offensive way, but it's almost like deer in the headlights. Uh-oh, we have a threat coming at us. What do we do? So there's a group that I think are just struggling with how to respond. There's a large group that wants, of pastors and leaders that want to be open, but maybe they're part of a denomination that has directed them otherwise, or they can't bring all the board members on board. So there's a group there. And then there's a group that are sort of vocally, I would say, more in favor of compliance. I don't know if too many that are literally in favor of lockdowns, but they're in favor of compliance. So yeah, probably the biggie would be their understanding of Romans 13 would be that the Church of Jesus Christ is required to submit to the governing authorities in all matters. And that would not be my understanding of that text at all. Mm-hmm. I think the government there has a very limited job description, and their responsibility is to wield the sword to which we are to surrender. That means they're responsible for public justice. And so the text goes on to talk about they punish the evildoer, they reward the righteous. It doesn't say that they have authority over your church ministry, when you meet, how you meet, under what circumstances you meet. But we live in a totalitarian, an increasing totalitarian system, right? So in our day and age, 2021, the average Western state, Canada among them, I mean, they have taken authority over your how you use your property, your health, taxation of your income. I mean, dog tags, permits to cut trees down, stickers on your license plate, everything, right? Well, everything is controlled. This was not the circumstance in the first century when Paul instructed individual Christians to surrender to the authority of the state. So where that Romans 13 text applies is it's not the role of the church to involve itself in the execution of public justice. It's not the role of the church to practice capital punishment, to set up courts, to deal with criminal matters. That's not the role of the church. That's the role of the state. But the church is separate from the state, and so the church is wise to maintain absolute control over its worship and ministry under, of course, the lordship of Jesus Christ. But I would say the primary argument would be a theological view that we're to surrender to the state in everything, and maybe the second concern would be fear. I mean, fear of killing your people dying. Mm-hmm. We live in a culture where we have a huge respect for medical officials. So if a physician says this is what we should do, people just kind of, okay, we better do it. So there's a deference, almost a cult-like deference to the medical establishment. And then I'm hearing increasingly churches that they're just concerned about getting fined. I mean, the fines are steep. Sure. You know, I remember my first fine. You do take a little gulp when you get a court summons that says, you know, you could pay up to $100,000 and do a year of your life in jail. I mean, it is it is strange for a law-abiding citizen to receive something like that. Of course, I've received a few more since. So after a while, they sort of lose their luster. But there is a concern about the financial penalties. But yeah, I would say the primarily a view of Romans 13, which says that you need to submit to the state in everything, a belief that physicians know best in every area of life, and then a concern for the legal consequences of not complying.
Right. So you said something interesting there, and I want to maybe poke at that a little bit. You said it's almost like a cult-like following of the medical establishment. Would you say that in a way like it's almost become an idol of our time?
Well, we live in a scientized culture. And, you know, in the old days, you take Oxford University, the first doctorate ever issued on planet Earth was in divinity. A doctor was someone who had mastered scripture and Christian theology. Nowadays, if you hear the word doctor, you automatically think, oh, a medical doctor. And when we have young kids growing up and they're being told, oh, it'd be great if you could be a doctor, right? There's an idolization, a reverence for the medical profession. Now, I'm not poo-pooing the medical profession. One of my very good friends is an MD. We have medical experts in our church that I've consulted extensively on our own response. I love these people. My wife almost died when we had our fifth child, and medical experts saved her life. I'm very grateful for the medical establishment. But if you listen to the cultural narrative, it's like, trust the science. You would never have someone in the secular world say, trust the Bible, trust divine revelation, trust theology, let's consult the clergyman. We have essentially taken clergy, religion, theology, the Bible, and we've tossed it to the side, and we've elevated the scientific method and scientific inquiry to godlike status. So I think there is a deification of science there. What we're seeing increasingly is the scientists don't even agree on this stuff.
Do you think there's been a fair debate?
Absolutely not. I mean, we have the, College of Surgeons and Physicians in Ontario threatening to remove the licenses of medical doctors that are speaking out against everything from vaccinations to lockdowns to the way to handle viruses and on and on and on. Mm-hmm. There's a censorship going on, which is shocking. So even the average physician may or may not agree with what's going on, but they're under great duress not to speak out. And so in actual fact, what we have in our country is we're being ruled by a very small group of technocrats, which is the term for like paid government officials, non-elected government officials. So we have our medical experts that are calling all the shots, and they have this, the mysterious panel of 40 experts that gain information from another mysterious panel of hundreds more, and they sort of tell us what to do. And the footage has come out where they're fumbling through their notes before they go live, and they're like, we just kind of read what's given to us. And we saw the footage of that several months ago with Dr. Williams and his associate here in Ontario. But what's happening is we have our premier, he'll get up and he'll defer to the technocrats. Well, what's whatever the chief medical officer says? Well, that's just one physician. And I'm sorry, but I know enough about medicine. When you go to medical school, you don't learn about how to lock people down or how to handle this kind of stuff. So a lot, you don't study the economic fallout, the spiritual trauma of lockdowns. These are not medical issues. These are a combination of political and medical issues, always sort of blended together. We're living in a point in time where we're being ruled by like a biopolitical ideology. It's an admixture of biological sciences, which we do respect if it's done properly, and politics. It's all blended and twisted and contorted together. And this is what concerns a lot of us. Like, if you just show me the raw science for something and it was peer reviewed and it was from someone without political liability, I'd be like, hey, great, awesome. Well, where is that? I mean, you call it something as simple as mask wearing, cloth mask wearing. We're not talking about N95 medical masks. Something as simple as wearing cloth masks. We directly asked our local health unit after months and months and months, said, okay, the time's up. Can you provide us with peer-reviewed articles demonstrating the efficacy of cloth masks to stop a virus? preferably from people without political liability. They said, we don't have it.
That's what they told you.
That we don't have it. So, I mean, how long do you have to wait to get medical evidence for something as simple as that? But you get everyone running around saying masks are the issue. Masks are this, you know, they're going to help us. So just something as simple as that. I think we should be concerned when we're being told a year and a half in what to do, but none of the quote unquote experts out there are actually willing to put their neck on the line and prove that what they're asking us to do is efficacious.
So let's talk about maybe the censorship that has happened, and you know, the shutting down of debate, and even some of the recent laws that we've seen kind of come into effect in Canada. Bill C-10
sure.
passed at 1:30 in the morning or whatever it was, that can monitor internet traffic and shut things down on the internet, and other things, some that do have implications for the church. Why should the church be worried about what we're seeing in censorship over this issue and what it could mean for the future of the church? And why should the church be concerned and maybe talking about this more?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, because one of the things that maybe sets guys like me apart from others is I'm looking at this from a macro perspective. So I'm looking at this viral threat with all of the cultural wars we're fighting in mind. So we have, look what's going on in our country. While we're in this quote unquote pandemic, which is even that word is ill-defined, but while we're in this pandemic, we have Bill C-6, we have Bill C-7, we have Bill C-10, we have Bill C-36. So we have the conversion therapy bill, we have the medical assistance in dying bill, we have the internet free speech bill, essentially. Now we have sort of the one-on-one free speech bill, the Bill C-36, where, you know, if you offend me, Ben, I can take you before a court. You could potentially be charged criminally for something I said recently or 5 years ago. And this should concern people. You know, many of our forebears literally died on battlefields to procure for their descendants liberty and freedom. And one of the tenets of Western civilization is, if you want to hear from wise men, you also have to let the fools speak. So we should be concerned if someone is advocating violence or the taking of life from a podium or a lectern. But this idea that Big Brother, the government, it should censor what we're allowed to say, what we're not allowed to say, almost what we're allowed to believe, what we're not allowed to believe, which is reflected in what we say, is deeply concerning. And that whole cancel culture, as we call it, that anti-free speech, sort of anti-liberty, censorship type culture, which is increasingly becoming the case in our country, is being applied opportunistically, I would argue, to the COVID situation. So that any news media personality that maybe questions it, they're turfed. If an MPP speaks out, the premier tosses him out of caucus. If a physician speaks out, you know, the CPSO is all over them, wanting to take their license away. You know, we have insurance companies calling churches, you guys better toe the line or we're going to strip you of your liability insurance, like they did here with our church. If you're a counselor or a mayor, we have Daryl Herlick, we have other elected officials, municipal, provincial, federal, that speak out. You're ejected or you're censored or on and on and on. Truth stands on its own 2 feet. And the way you best stand for truth in a culture is you let fools say what they want. And then they're exposed by the truth, right? And so whether you are pro or against the lockdown, you would be well advised to listen to the other side, as I try to do. You listen to the other side of the argument. You try to weigh them. You don't say, hey, what we're going to do is we're just going to live in this little echo chamber and just listen to the voices in our own heads going round and around and round, like self-affirm. So I think we're seeing that. I mean, I shouldn't even say I think we're seeing it. It's factual. It's happening in our culture. And if we're going to find a way forward, we need to be careful about allowing these opportunists to promote these, you know, anti-free speech, anti-liberty ideologies, because they're going to affect the ability of the church, right?
Well, what would you say to maybe people of the church and other leaders in the church who question what role the church should have in questioning government and, sure. and even being involved in any type of political topic at all? You know, maybe you hear the common phrase, you know, separation of church and sure. state and these sorts of and people think that we shouldn't have anything to do with it. What would you say to people like that, that think that way?
Well, we're all at a disadvantage because prior to this COVID crisis in our nation, in high school civics, we're not taught about the historical separation of church and state. It's really not brought up in our church as much of any denomination. We don't talk about it a whole lot. Probably the Reformed churches do the best job at it. Many of us are sort of re-educating ourselves and trying to understand in a clear way what is the role of the church and state. So I give people a lot of grace who just haven't thought through the issues because we're kind of being forced in a very rapid way to think through them. But we can go back in our history, right? So the West, sort of date that to the time of Constantine. So we're living in what we call a Western world, the Western world, sort of North America, Europe, where the descendants of certain systems and beliefs and people groups that were Christianized, that they weren't all Christian, like bona fide Christian, but the Western world historically has been Christianized in that its jurisprudence is based on the foundation of biblical law, its understanding of the family and the church and the role of a state is based upon biblical categories, right? And so now all of that's being challenged. But real quick history lesson. Historically, in Western culture, we understood that the state had a specific job description, primarily governance and public justice. The church had a specific job description to worship the risen Christ, you know, to convert the lost, to be the hands and feet of Christ and meeting the needs and challenges of our world. And so out of that, you know, Western churches were involved in the establishment of hospitals, educational institutions, universities, seminaries, what now becomes like social welfare systems. All of those wonderful things that are part of Western civilization are largely a result of the hard work of our Christian forebears. Now, what happens is a lot of these institutions and things that churches establish end up being passed off to the state because right. of funding or coercive pressure, whatever it might be.
And so has the church almost lost its purpose a bit?
It has. I mean, even when you think of taxation, I just wrote an article on this. A lot of people think that, you know, churches not paying taxes is some sort of a gift from the benevolent state. It's not. Historically, Western peoples understood that the reason why churches weren't taxed is because they were embassies. They were representing Christ on foreign soil. Taxation is to claim authority over a subject. The churches weren't taxed because they were not subject to the authority of the state over their worship and ministry. They were always subject to the authority of the state over criminal matters. So if a church, for example, is allowing criminal activity to take place within its walls, you know, people being executed or something, or children being molested, the state has a right and responsibility to step in and execute public justice. But over the worship and ministry of the church, it's unprecedented in Western civilization for any state to think they have authority over whether I can baptize, whether I can sing, whether I can gather my people, whether I can officiate at funerals or weddings or counsel people. It's a shocking claim for the state to claim authority over the church in those things. But it's done it largely because the church has passed off its ministry to a secular state, and almost feels, I get this vibe from a lot of Christians where they almost feel inferior to the state, inferior to culture. Oh, you know, please let us exist. Please let us keep our tax exempt status. Please approve us. Please like us. And this is a critical error that the Western church, and especially in Canada, has made. And even allowing ourselves to be declared this ridiculous language, essential and non-essential. Non-essential? Like, are you kidding me? We're the Church of Jesus Christ. We're delivering the gospel of Jesus Christ into a lost and dying world. How sick and perverted for a Christian minister to be barred from being at the bedside of someone who's dying of COVID-19 in a hospital ward. How terrible is that? How terrible is it for us not to be able to gather and baptize and worship? So there's the separation of church and state. You asked a question of politics. If politics is actually politics, it's about the city, it's about, you know, roads and construction and good governance, the state, the church doesn't need to involve itself in that. But the reason why churches need to become more quote-unquote political, using it from a not modern perspective, is because politicians have become more theological. Mm. They're taking our job away from us. They're trying to, you know, they're telling us who we can worship, who we can't worship, what's right, what's wrong, what marriage is, and how we can educate our kids. They've taken it from us. So if I'm accused of being more political, it's only because the state has become more theological.
Interesting. So do you think this has caught other, you know, the other church leaders and maybe even yourself at one point in all of this off guard completely, how rapidly this has happened, the speed and ferocity of maybe what's happened in the last year? Do you think people are a little bit stunned?
It's interesting. I've been pastoring now for 28 years, and so, you know, more of my life I've been a pastor than I haven't been. And a lot of older pastors will say things like, I'm not shocked at anything anymore, right? But I got to say, there's times that I'm still shocked, even almost 3 decades into ministry. I'm still shocked at people's behavior. I mean, sometimes I'm shocked at my own behavior too.
Yeah.
But I'm shocked at the rapidity of this. I am shocked at the willingness of especially churches to capitulate. Those that truly have capitulated, many, you know, have a rationale, but those that, I guess I have some respect for someone that believes we should comply, believes there's a devastating threat that requires a closure of the church. I have respect for a group of elders or church leaders that make that decision in an uncoerced way, even if I disagree with it. What's hard to stomach is churches that know it's wrong and don't actually feel comfortable with it, capitulating just because the consequences are so dire or potentially dire. You know, I would encourage churches to at least challenge the narrative, you know, at least push back, at least make the phone calls and dialogue with your political allies and ask hard questions. I mean, the hypocrisy out there is a good place to start, right? So we have churches out west where the pastors have been in prison, here fined exorbitant sums and churches locked out. But the premier, if he decides to have to attend a vigil for a truly tragic event in London, he just kind of writes a little line or two into the Reopening Ontario Act on June 8th, 2021. I'm going to allow myself to do this. Allows 15,000 or whatever it was people to attend with absolute political immunity. And I'm in favor of vigils. I'm in favor of protests. I think people should be able to do as they see fit in a free and democratic society. But the hypocrisy and the double standards is insane.
Like if it truly was dangerous.
Yeah, if it truly was dangerous and to the degree that if it's so important that I should close my church down and not do funerals and not officiate at weddings and not counsel people and just push all my people onto Zoom church, if it's that deadly for several hundred people to meet here, well, what on earth would you allow thousands upon thousands upon thousands to mourn even a tragic event? Like you would just kind of wait out and say, oh, we can't do that.
More people may die, right?
More people might die.
Right, okay.
So the double standards and, you know, the story after story after story for the past 15, 16 months of jet-setting politicians taking trips to the Caribbean, to attending BLM rallies, to, you know, secretly, you know, our own health official here in Windsor, Essex, showing up at a wedding, you know, trips to the cottage while everyone else is, you know, at home terrified because if they step outside, they're going to be responsible for the deaths of all kinds of people. Like the hypocrisy, and you know, by the way, I'll just say this, hypocrisy, if you think about it, like why do people sometimes fall into the trap of hypocrisy? Because they don't actually believe what they're saying they believe, or they're just incredibly selfish and inconsistent. So I just think so much of this is driven by politics, and not all of it, but there's a medical threat out there that needs to be mitigated, but so much of it is driven by political considerations.
Yeah. Okay, well, we'll have to break for today and come back next time for the second part of this interaction with Dr. Aaron Rock here at Harvest Bible Church in Windsor. Thank you for your time today.
Thanks again for listening to Views Through Another Mic. I hope Ben and Aaron's conversation helped you process some questions you may have. Subscribe to this program wherever you listen to podcasts for future episodes. We will continue our conversation next time in part 2 of Godly and Earthly Authority.